This is Audible.
Hyperion Audio presents Jacqueline Kennedy, Historic Conversations on Life with John F. Kennedy. Seven conversations between Jacqueline Kennedy and Arthur M. Schlesinger, Jr., with a foreword by Caroline Kennedy and an introduction by Michael Beschloss.
Foreword. This is Caroline Kennedy. It is my great honor to bring forward these recollections. In 1964, as part of an oral history project on the life and career of John F. Kennedy, my mother sat down with Arthur M. Schlesinger, Jr., to contribute her memories and insights. Recorded less than 4 months after the death of her husband, they represent a gift to history and a labor of love on her part. In order to treat them with the appropriate respect, my children and I took very seriously the decision to publish them now, in connection with the 50th anniversary of my father's presidency. The moment seems right. Enough time has passed so that they can be appreciated for their unique insight. Yet the Kennedy presidency is still within living memory for many who will find her observations illuminating. I hope, too, that younger generations who are just learning about the 1960s will find these reminiscences a useful introduction to how history is made, and inspire them to give back to this country that has given us all so much. When I was growing up, my mother spent much of her time meeting behind closed doors with members of my father's administration, planning his gravesite at Arlington National Cemetery, making sure that the John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts would reflect his commitment to our country's cultural heritage, executing his wishes for the John F. Kennedy Presidential Library and the Institute of Politics, and making countless decisions on the disposition of my father's official papers, personal effects, mementos, and memorabilia. She was determined that the Kennedy Library be a living memorial, a place where students would be inspired to pursue careers in public service, where scholars would have access to the historical record, and where families could learn about the ideals that animated my father's career and his vision for America. To my brother and me, these meetings were somewhat mysterious, but we had a sense that nothing was more important than the oral history that we heard about from time to time. My parents shared a love of history. To them, the past was not an academic concern, but rather a gathering of the most fascinating people you could ever hope to meet. My father's interests were political. I still have his books on the Civil War and English parliamentary history, as well as his annotated copy of the Federalist Papers. My mother thought there weren't enough women in American history to make it as interesting as reading novels and diaries from the courts of Europe. She read War and Peace during the Wisconsin primary and maintained that reading the memoirs of the Duke de Saint-Simon about life at Versailles was the most valuable preparation she received for life in the White House. After my father's death, she was determined to do everything she could to make sure that the record of his administration was preserved for posterity. She had confidence that his decisions would stand the test of time and show future generations what an extraordinary man he was. Although my mother took the long view, she also knew the value of the immediate impression. She helped set in motion one of the most extensive oral history projects ever conducted up to that time, in which more than 1,000 people were interviewed about their life and work with John F. Kennedy. Although it was painful for my mother to relive the life since shattered, she knew it was important that she participate. She always told us that she chose to be interviewed by Arthur M. Schlesinger, Jr., the Pulitzer Prize-winning historian, former Harvard professor, and special assistant to President Kennedy, because she was doing this for the future. And that was also why she put the tapes in a vault to be sealed for 50 years. I first read transcripts of these conversations a few weeks after my mother's death in 1994 when the vault was opened and her lawyer gave me a copy. Everything about that time was overwhelming for me, as I found myself faced with the same sorts of decisions about her possessions that she had made 30 years earlier. Knowing her wishes for the oral history made it easy. I knew I was reading something that wasn't supposed to be seen yet, and although I found it fascinating and was eager to share it with others, I put it back in the vault to await its time. A few years ago, my family began thinking about how to commemorate the 50th anniversary of my father's presidency. We decided to concentrate our efforts on projects that would make his legacy accessible worldwide. Working with the staff of the John F. Kennedy Library and Foundation, my husband created the largest digital archive of a presidency, as well as online curricula, downloadable exhibits, and a website that will renew my father's call to service for today's generation. The publication of these interviews is an important contribution to this commemorative effort, and one with its own story. When the director of the Kennedy Library first approached me with the idea, I asked him to search the archives to confirm my mother's wishes regarding the date of publication. Surprisingly, given the importance of the material, there was no deed of gift or transfer, nor a letter of intent regarding the date at which the interviews were to be opened. There was only a brief notation by a former government archivist that these interviews were, quote, subject to the same restrictions as the Manchester interviews, unquote. By way of background, there are three significant interviews that my mother gave after my father's death. The first was to Theodore H. White in Hyannisport on November 29, 1963, only a few days after my father's funeral. In that interview, my mother famously told White that she and my father used to listen to the record of the Broadway musical Camelot in the evening before they went to bed. And looking back, that one brief shining moment reminded her of his presidency. White's article was published a week later in Life magazine, but the notes of his interview were sealed until 1 year after my mother's death. They are now open to researchers at the Kennedy Library in Boston. The second set of conversations was with William Manchester, who was writing a book called The Death of a President. During the sessions, my mother said more about my father's assassination than she had intended. Subsequently, she became so upset at the thought of her personal memories being public that she sued the author and publisher to keep them out of the book. A settlement was reached, and although much of the content had made its way into the public sphere, the notes of the interviews were sealed for 100 years. That is, until 2067. But by far the most important were these oral history conversations, in which my mother willingly recalled the span of her married life and shared her insights into my father's private and public political personality. The archivist's notation was not consistent with my memory, nor did it seem to reflect my mother's wishes. I checked with former members of her staff in the White House and afterwards, as well as friends and attorneys. No one had a recollection that differed from mine, and I was surprised by their enthusiasm for publication. So I was faced with a dilemma that I have confronted numerous times in connection with my mother's personal papers and correspondence. On the one hand, she was a famously private person who gave no on-the-record interviews, other than these three, about life in the White House, and requested in her will that my brother and I make every effort to prevent publication of her personal papers, letters, and writings. However, she also saved every scrap of paper that came her way, every birthday card or telegram, every letter from her parents, every date book and diary, every draft letter or memo she ever wrote. She knew that living in the White House was an enormous privilege, and she was proud of the part she had played. Early on, when she discovered that one of her secretaries was throwing out notes and internal correspondence that chronicled both daily life and the official workings of the mansion, she wrote a steaming rebuke, directing everyone on her staff to save even the smallest scribbles. Her deep immersion in memoirs of the past informed her belief that she had an obligation to preserve everything that happened during her time in the White House. In the years since her death, I have asked myself the question, when does someone no longer belong to you, but belong to history? Few people have been exploited more than my mother, and I grew up feeling I needed to protect her, just as she had protected us. So at first, I thought it best to leave these interviews sealed for another 50 years, rather than to expose her memory to one more round of gossip and speculation. But I also understand that the continuing interest in her life is a tribute to the immense admiration and goodwill she still commands, and I believe that open access to government is an important American value. Over the years, I have received multiple requests to publish my mother's memos and correspondence. At times, it has been difficult to balance her wish for privacy against her public role and pay proper respect to both. Although I agonize over each request, I know that my mother trusted my judgment and felt that I understood the way she saw the world. As the years pass, it has become less painful to share her with the public, and in fact, it's a privilege. As her child, it's sometimes hard for me to reconcile that most people can identify my mother instantly, but they really don't know her at all. They may have a sense of her style and her dignified public persona, but they don't appreciate her intellectual curiosity, her sense of the ridiculous, her sense of adventure, or her sense of what was right. Over time, I've tried to draw the line between her public and private life, much as I think she did. I try to accommodate requests that pertain to my father's career, life in the White House, historic events, and historic preservation, while denying permission for publication of her writings as a private citizen, whether as a young woman or a working editor. These conversations are not in the same category as her personal writings, because they were recorded with the intention that they would be made public one day. So it was not a question of whether to publish, but a question of when. But my experience with other requests informed my decision that the time was right. In reaching this conclusion, I found it helpful to remember the context in which the interviews were conducted and the timing of when they occurred. The goal was to create a record of my father's life and career from the memories of those who knew and worked with him. Accordingly, the questions follow a loosely chronological sequence, beginning with my father's early political battles in Massachusetts, his 1956 fight for the vice presidential nomination, the 1960 campaign, the transition to the presidency, the inauguration, the Bay of Pigs, the Cuban Missile Crisis, official and family life in the White House, and plans for the 1964 campaign and a second term. Along the way, there are discussions that reveal much about the central characters and events of the time in both domestic politics and international affairs. The decision was complicated by my conviction that if my mother had reviewed the transcripts, there's no doubt she would have made revisions. She was a young widow in the extreme stages of grief. The interviews were conducted only 4 months after she had lost her husband, her home, and her sense of purpose. She had 2 young children to raise alone. It isn't surprising that there are some statements she would later have considered too personal, and others too harsh. Her views certainly evolved over time. I struggled with the question of whether to delete remarks that would be taken out of context and distorted. I knew that if I did, I could be accused of trying to manipulate her image, even if the edited version was, paradoxically, a more accurate reflection of how she really felt. After much deliberation, I decided to maintain the integrity of the audio interviews as a primary source, while editing the text slightly for readability, not content, as has been done with other presidential transcripts and oral history interviews. My reservations were mitigated by the remarkable immediacy and informality of the conversations. Knowing my mother so well, I can hear her voice in my mind when I read her words on a page. I can tell when she's emotional, when she's enjoying herself, or is getting annoyed, though she is unfailingly polite. Even though most of her answers are about my father, by listening to the audio, people will learn a great deal about the person that she was. Much is revealed by her tone and by her pauses as well as by her statements. I trust that readers and listeners will place her views in context to build an accurate and composite portrait of a person and a moment in time. And I'm confident that her integrity, her humor, and her devotion to her husband will come through to others as they do to me. In addition to their passion for history, my parents shared a conviction that American civilization had come of age, and they wanted to share our artistic and cultural achievements with the world. Today, this seems an unremarkable proposition, but at the time, the United States was just emerging as a global power, and people still looked to Europe for direction and leadership. My parents believed America should lead with her ideals, not just with economic or military power. My mother played a critical role in the development of what is now called soft diplomacy. She traveled with my father and on her own, often speaking the language of the countries she visited. She was an international sensation and helped elevate our national image. She understood that the White House itself was a powerful symbol of our democracy and wanted to make sure it projected the best of America to students and families who visited, as well as to foreign heads of state who were entertained there. She worked hard, not to redecorate, a word she hated, but to restore the White House so that the legacy of John Adams, Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, Abraham Lincoln, and Franklin Roosevelt would be visible. She recast the White House Library to showcase classic works of American history and literature. She established the Fine Arts Committee and the White House Historical Association to assemble a permanent collection of American paintings and decorative arts that would become one of the nation's finest. She made the White House the world's greatest stage and invited the world's foremost artists to perform there. She welcomed young musicians, emerging African-American opera singers, jazz musicians, and modern dancers, all to awaken and expand appreciation for American arts and culture. She also felt strongly that as our capital city, Washington, D.C., should reflect America's newly prominent place in the world. She fought to preserve Lafayette Square and launched the effort to rehabilitate Pennsylvania Avenue, an effort that's been sustained ever since. My mother understood that the past was a source of pride for people around the world, just as it is in America, and convinced my father that the United States could build goodwill among countries like Egypt, with which we had political differences, by assisting in their historic preservation efforts. Her persistence resulted in a generous U.S. contribution to the UNESCO rescue of the temples of Abu Simbel, which were threatened by the construction of the Aswan Dam, and favorably impressed the Nasser regime. In another example of cultural diplomacy, my mother was responsible for the Mona Lisa's visit to the United States, the only time the painting has ever left the Louvre. Most important, she believed her responsibility was to help my father in every way she could. Although she became a diplomatic and even a political asset, she never thought she deserved the title First Lady, which she disliked anyway, claiming it sounded like the name of a cheap racehorse. But she was deeply patriotic and proud of what she accomplished, and my father was proud of her too. Their time in the White House was the happiest of her life. Given the important role Jacqueline Kennedy played in the presidency of John F. Kennedy and its aftermath, it seemed a disservice to let her perspective remain absent from the public and scholarly debate that would accompany the 50th anniversary of the Kennedy administration. 50 years seems a sufficient amount of time for passions to have cooled, yet recent enough that the world described still has much to teach us. The sense of time passing was made more acute by the loss of my Uncle Teddy and my Aunt Eunice in 2009, by Ted Sorensen in 2010, and my Uncle Sarge in January 2011. But before making the final decision, I asked my children to read the transcripts and tell me what they thought. Their reactions were not so different from my own. They found the conversations dated in many ways, especially my mother's description of marriage and the role of women in politics, but fascinating in many more. They loved the stories about their grandfather and how insightful yet irreverent their grandmother was. They were puzzled by some of Arthur Schlesinger's questions, personal rivalries he pursued, and particular issues that have not stood the test of time. They wished that he had asked more questions about her. But they came away with the same conclusions that I had reached. There was no significant reason to put off publication, and no one speaks better for my mother than she does herself.
Introduction. This is Michael Beschloss. So now, at long last, it's her turn to speak. If you pour through any of the thousands of books about John Fitzgerald Kennedy, you'll find the voice of one crucial witness virtually absent. As the New York Times obituary said the morning after her death on May 19, 1994, her silence about her past, especially about the Kennedy years and her marriage to the president, was always something of a mystery. She wrote no autobiography or memoir. Jacqueline Lee Bouvier was born on July 28, 1929, in Southampton, New York, the summer family seat of both her paternal and maternal lines. Her suntanned, Yale-educated, French-American father John V. Bouvier III had followed his forefathers to Wall Street, but his career never recovered from the stock market crash of 1929. Her mother, Janet Norton Lee, was the daughter of a self-made Irish-American tycoon in New York banking and real estate. From her Park Avenue and Long Island childhood, Jackie liked to ride horses, create whimsical drawings, and read books, especially art history, poetry, French history, and literature. When she was 12, her parents were bitterly divorced, and her mother wed Hugh D. Auchincloss, Jr., who made Jackie and her younger sister Lee at home on his picturesque estates in McLean, Virginia, and Newport, Rhode Island. As a student at Miss Porter's school in Connecticut, where she boarded her horse Tansuz, teachers found Jackie strong-willed, irreverent, and highly intelligent. After 2 years at Vassar, which did not inspire her, the young woman sprang to life during a junior year at the Sorbonne and the University of Grenoble. Returning to live at Marywood, her stepfather's house on the Potomac, she was graduated in 1951 from George Washington University and surpassed 1,200 other college women to win Vogue's Prix de Paris, for which she designed an issue of the magazine and wrote an essay on People I Wish I Had Known. The prize offered a year as a Vogue junior editor in New York and Paris. She declined it, to the relief of her mother, who was inclined to take her daughter's strong interest in France as an unwelcome sign of allegiance to Jack Bouvier. Instead, Jackie took a job as inquiring photographer for the Washington Times Herald. In that role, she began seeing the man who would become her husband. The first time she had met Jack Kennedy was in 1948, on a train from Washington, D.C. to New York, when, as she recorded at the time, she briefly chatted with an attentive, tall, thin young congressman with very long reddish hair. But the encounter came to naught. That same year, Jacqueline's family friend Charles Bartlett took her across a great crowd at his brother's Long Island wedding to meet Jack Kennedy. But as Bartlett recalled, by the time I got her across, why, he'd left. Finally, in the spring of 1951, in the Bartlett's Georgetown dining room, Jack and Jackie had their official introduction. After what she called a spasmodic courtship, the Francophile aesthete and the fast-ascending senator from Massachusetts married in Newport on September 12, 1953. Launching the decade of their life, which you will hear about in this audiobook. During the days after John Kennedy's murder, his 34-year-old widow found memories of their White House life, which she calls in this volume our happiest years, so traumatic that she asked her Secret Service drivers to please design her trips so she would never accidentally glimpse the old mansion. She intended to stay away from the White House for the rest of her life, and she did, with only one exception. In 1971, when Aaron Schickler finished his official portraits of the 35th president and his wife, she agreed to view the portraits in private along with her children at the White House and joined President Richard Nixon and his family in their upstairs dining room. At the end of 1963, Mrs. Kennedy knew that reminiscing at length about life with her husband would make her start to cry again, but she was determined to win Jack a fair hearing from historians. Since JFK had been deprived of the chance afforded other presidents of defending their historical record in books, articles, and public statements, she felt an overwhelming obligation to do whatever she could. To ensure that he was not forgotten, within days of Dallas, Jackie was already trying to imagine the architecture of a future Kennedy library, planned for Harvard, on a Charles River site selected by the president just a month before he died. At the start of December 1963, when the widow and her children had not yet departed their White House quarters, her husband's aide, Arthur Schlesinger, Jr., amassed some of the most moving letters he had received about his late boss and sent them upstairs to Mrs. Kennedy. The bow-tied Schlesinger, known for his acid wit and a magnificent bounce to his step, was an ex-Harvard history professor, one of the nation's most respected scholars, and author of award-winning books on the ages of Andrew Jackson and Franklin Roosevelt. He had known JFK since they were Harvard students together, but his friendship with Jackie had really begun during the 1960 presidential campaign, when her husband, wishing not to be seen encircled by liberal academics, had asked Schlesinger to send him campaign advice through her. Now, in the wake of the assassination, the historian was already planning research for the book on the 35th presidency that JFK and other aides had always presumed that Schlesinger would one day write. From her White House rooms, Jacqueline replied in longhand to Schlesinger's note. She wrote, "I return your letters. I am so happy to have seen them. I have not had time to read any yet. She reported that someone had urged that the Kennedy Library try to sustain her husband's influence on the young. She wrote, "Well, I don't see how it can keep going without him, but you could think of a way. It would be nice to try." She told Schlesinger she had been very impressed by an address he had given about her husband. She wrote, "It was all the things I thought about Jack. Even though he didn't live to see his dreams accomplished, he so badly wanted to be a great president. I think he still can be, because he started those ideas, which is what you said. And he should be great for that." She urged Schlesinger to write about her husband soon, while all is fresh, while you still remember his exact words. As Schlesinger later recalled, "An oral history project was much on my mind after Dallas, and also on Robert Kennedy's mind." At Harvard, Schlesinger had been an early champion of this new research method. Anxious that important historical evidence was getting lost because people were writing fewer letters and diaries, pioneers at Columbia University and elsewhere were interviewing historical figures, taping the conversations, and placing the transcripts in public archives. Writing that it was a matter of urgency, Schlesinger reminded Jacqueline that in contrast to Presidents Truman and Eisenhower, who kept diaries and wrote surprisingly revealing letters, John Kennedy's leadership was often exercised on the telephone or in person, leaving no written record. He warned her that without a crash oral history program, capturing memories from new frontiersmen while they were still crisp, much of the Kennedy history would disappear. In January 1964, Jacqueline and Robert Kennedy approved a plan for scholars and members of the Kennedy Circle to record the recollections of thousands of people who knew the president. Relatives, friends, cabinet secretaries, Massachusetts Pauls, foreign leaders, and others who had enjoyed more than a perfunctory relationship with him. Along with RFK's own oral history, the centerpiece of the collection would be interviews with John Kennedy's widow, which would be performed by Schlesinger himself. Thus, on Monday, March 2, 1964, Schlesinger walked to Jacqueline Kennedy's new home at 3017 N Street and climbed a long flight of wooden steps to start the first of seven interviews with the former First Lady. In her grief, Mrs. Kennedy had bought this 1794 house, which stood across the street from the house that was once Robert Todd Lincoln's. She was doing her best to provide a normal life for 6-year-old Caroline and 3-year-old John, which she saw as both her duty and her salvation. Tourist buses stopped outside, disgorging sightseers who littered her steps, pointed Instamatic cameras at her front windows, and called out her children's names, forcing her to keep the curtains in her freshly painted white living room closed. Inside the house, passing through sliding doors, Schlesinger had joined Jacqueline in the living room. On the bookshelves were artifacts from ancient Rome, Egypt, and Greece that President Kennedy had given her over the years. Facing away from the front windows, she sat on a crushed velvet sofa. On a 3-tiered table beside her were 2 framed photographs: the smiling JFK at his desk, clapping while his children danced, another with him campaigning among a crowd. Placing his tape recorder beside a silver cigarette box on a low black oriental table, Schlesinger sat to Mrs. Kennedy's right on a pale yellow chair he had seen upstairs at the White House. He urged her to speak as though addressing an historian of the 21st century. As he later recalled, "From time to time she would ask me to turn off the machine so that she could say what she wanted to say, and then ask, 'Should I say that on the recorder?' In general, what I would say was, 'Why don't you say it? You have control over the transcript.'" During this and the next 6 sittings, starting with a quavering voice that grew stronger with time, Jacqueline unburdened herself, as the tape machine also picked up the sounds of her lighting cigarettes, ice cubes in glasses, dogs barking in the distance, trucks rumbling down N Street, and jets roaring overhead. For anyone who doubts Jacqueline Kennedy's emotional self-discipline, note that during these months of her greatest despair, she could will herself to speak in such detail about her vanished former life. And Schlesinger was not her only interlocutor that spring. In April 1964, she sat for hours at night in that same parlor to be questioned by William Manchester, who was researching his authorized book about the assassination. In order to spare Mrs. Kennedy the trauma of twice recording those events, Schlesinger left the task to Manchester. And on the June day after she completed her final interview with Schlesinger, She sat down in that same room to be questioned by members of the Warren Commission about the ordeal of her husband's final motorcade. Read after almost a half century, the interviews in this book revise scene after scene of the history of the late 1950s and early 1960s that we thought we knew. While no such work ever tells the entire story, this oral history constitutes a fresh, expansive internal narrative of John Kennedy's life as senator, candidate, and president, and his wife's experience of those years, providing new detail on what JFK and Jacqueline privately said to each other, her backstage role in his political life, diplomacy and world crises, and her definite and consistently original views about the changing cast of characters who surrounded them both. The close student of the Kennedy years knows how Jackie expanded her husband's range with her command of French and Spanish, her knowledge of the history of Europe and its colonies, and her background in the arts. But even today, many presume that she was relatively indifferent to political life. When Schlesinger met her at Hyannisport in 1959, he found her flighty on politics, asking elementary questions with what he called wide-eyed naivete. This was not surprising. Well-bred young women of Jacqueline's generation were not encouraged to sound like intellectuals, nor would it help her husband for her to vent her opinions around any but their most trusted friends. But as this oral history confirms, she knew considerably more about John Kennedy's political life than she ever let on to outsiders, and her influence on his official relationships was substantial. Nevertheless, Jacqueline Kennedy would have been the last person to suggest that she was some kind of hidden White House policy guru. As she conveys in this volume, she considered it her role not to badger her husband about labor safety or international law, as Eleanor Roosevelt had with Franklin, but to provide JFK with what she called a climate of affection. With intriguing dinner guests, appealing food, and the children in good moods, to help him escape the pressures of leading the free world through one of the most dangerous periods of the Cold War. To the surprise of both the President and the First Lady, she became, with her beauty and star quality, a huge political asset. Legions of American women wanted to walk, talk, dress, wear their hair, and arrange their homes like Jackie. It was not casually that in the fall of 1963, the president lobbied her to join him on campaign trips to Texas and California. On his final morning before an audience in Fort Worth, he joked about his wife's appeal, mock complaining that nobody wonders what Lyndon and I wear. As First Lady, Mrs. Kennedy was not a feminist, at least as the word is understood today. Betty Friedan's Pathbreaking the Feminine Mystique was published in 1963, but the women's movement was almost a decade in the future. In this book, Mrs. Kennedy suggests that women should find their sense of purpose through their husbands, and that the old-fashioned style of marriage was the best. She describes her first White House social secretary as sort of a feminist, and says she was so different from me. She even observes that women should stay out of politics because they're too emotional, views that by the 1970s she emphatically dropped. Despite such comments, no one can argue that this First Lady did not make her own strong-minded choices about her life and work. Resisting those who counseled her to emulate some of her more conventional predecessors, she made it clear from the start that her supreme job was not to attend charity events or political banquets, but to raise her children well amid the blast of attention surrounding a president's family. Other public projects she undertook at no one's behest but her own. Through the run of these interviews, Mrs. Kennedy gives short shrift to those achievements. That was because Schlesinger's oral histories were intended to focus on her husband, and the fact that in 1964, even so knowing an historian as Schlesinger regarded a First Lady's story as essentially a side event, which caused him to treat Jacqueline primarily as a source on her husband. This is unfortunate, because among the First Ladies of the 20th century, probably only Eleanor Roosevelt had a greater impact on Americans. One of Jacqueline Kennedy's lasting contributions was to herald the importance of historical preservation. The 1950s and 1960s were a time when American architects and city planners were eager to raise urban monuments in neighborhoods that seemed dated in order to make room for new highways, office buildings, stadiums, and public housing. Without Mrs. Kennedy's intervention, some of Washington, D.C.'s crown jewels would have disappeared. For example, Lafayette Square facing the White House, which Pierre L'Enfant, the original architect of Washington, D.C., had imagined as the President's Park. A plan was in fast motion to destroy almost all of the 19th-century houses and buildings on the east and west sides of Lafayette Park, including the mansion of Dolly Madison's widowhood and the 1861 building that had been the Capitol's first art museum. In their place would go so-called modern white marble federal office towers that would dwarf the White House. Walking around the square, Jacqueline recalled learning when she was a student in Paris about how the French protected their vital buildings and places. She wished that the U.S. House and Senate would pass a law similar to what they did in France. She wrote that she would not sit still while America's monuments were ripped down and horrible things put up in their place. She wrote, "I simply panic at the thought of this and decided to make a last-minute appeal." An eminent American architect complained that there was practically nothing on the square's west side worth preserving. He said, "I hope Jacqueline Kennedy wakes up to the fact that she lives in the 20th century." But Mrs. Kennedy prevailed. She wrote one of her co-conspirators, "Hold your breath. All our wildest dreams come true. The Dolly, Madison, and Taylor houses will be saved." Had someone else been First Lady, the vista seen by presidential families and guests from the Executive Mansion's north windows today might be very bleak. She also managed to save the old gray mansard-crowned executive office building built in the 1870s next to the White House, which had once housed the departments of State, War, and Navy. In January 1961, when the Kennedys rode down Pennsylvania Avenue toward their new home, they were newly reminded that L'Enfant's design for a grand ceremonial mile from the Capitol to the White House had given way to tattoo parlors and souvenir stores. Sometimes at night, unbeknownst to the public, she and Jack would walk halfway to the Capitol, as she later scrawled in a letter to her brother-in-law, Senator Edward Kennedy. She wrote of her husband, "The tawdriness of the encroachments to the president's house depressed him. He wished to do something that would ensure a nobility of architecture along that avenue which is the main artery of the government of the United States. He wished to emulate Thomas Jefferson, with whom he had such great instinctive affinity." She wrote Ted, "I just wanted to tell you with all my heart that this is one thing that really meant something to Jack." Thanks to her, a commission was established for the boulevard's redevelopment, and it was closely overseen by both the President and First Lady. Jacqueline wrote Ted Kennedy that Pennsylvania Avenue was one of the last things I remember Jack speaking about with feeling before leaving for Texas in November of 1963. Most famous of all, Jacqueline recast the White House as a treasure house of historic American furniture, painting, sculpture, and artifacts that would rival world-renowned museums. For the 160 years after Abigail and John Adams became the first residents of the White House, presidential families had restyled the mansion's public rooms at their whim. When Jacqueline Kennedy first looked closely at these rooms, her heart sank. The bad wallpaper and reproductions reminded her of a Statler Hilton, almost devoid of American history. She drafted a plan to persuade wealthy collectors to donate important American pieces, remake the public rooms with careful research into proper historical venues, and establish a White House Historical Association, as Jackie wrote, to keep some future president's wife whose aunt ran a curio shop from revamping those rooms to that wife's own ahistorical taste. Especially after Jacqueline's televised tour of the newly remade White House in February 1962, which was seen by 56 million viewers, the project helped make Americans more aware of their traditions in the decorative arts. Enduring, too, are certain other ways Mrs. Kennedy changed what she called the setting in which the presidency is presented to the world, including the ritual for state dinners and other presidential ceremonies. She transformed the previously austere Oval Office into what she called a New England sitting room by moving in sofas and easy chairs, unsealing its fireplace, and installing the massive HMS Resolute desk, which has since been used by five of her husband's successors. It was at Jacqueline's request that the industrial designer Raymond Loewy conceived the sky blue and white design of today's presidential air fleet. Mrs. Kennedy also reconceptualized the role of the First Lady. Since her transformation of the White House, a venture she conceived and assigned to herself, every president's wife has felt compelled to focus on some important public project. The 31-year-old Jackie was serious when she said her preeminent job in the White House was to be wife and mother, but as Lady Bird Johnson later recalled, she was a worker, which I don't think was always quite recognized. With that work ethic, it was therefore natural that Jacqueline would take on the restoration project, which she knew would prove exhausting. She had had a full-time job after graduation from college, which was unusual in her social group, and in 1975, when her second husband Aristotle Onassis had died and both of her children were away at school, she took on a real job as a book editor at Viking and Doubleday, with a reputation for quality volumes of art and history that benefited from her taste, life experience, and expertise. Jackie's capacity for intellectual growth, which was apparent in the White House, showed itself in the 1970s with her embrace of the women's movement. She told a friend she had come to realize that she could not expect to live primarily through her husband. She championed various feminist causes, including Gloria Steinem's Ms. Magazine, and despite her aversion to giving interviews, she gave one in praise of working women for a 1979 cover story in Steinem's magazine. In her interview, she said, "What has been sad for many women of my generation is that they weren't supposed to work if they had families." But in the early 1960s, all of this was in Jacqueline Kennedy's future. Retrospectively, she felt that of equal importance to her White House restoration were her far less well-known efforts as First Lady to save Abu Simbel. Alarmed to learn in 1962 that floods were threatening the exalted Egyptian monument, she wrote JFK, "It is the major temple of the Nile, 13th century B.C. It would be like letting the Parthenon be flooded. Abu Simbel is the greatest. Nothing will ever be found to equal it." Despite JFK's insistence that congressmen would dismiss Abu Simbel as some Egyptian rocks, the First Lady's personal appeal to Congress won Egypt the necessary funds. When Egypt's president, Gamal Abdel Nasser, offered to send one of his country's treasures to America as a thank-you gift, she requested the Temple of Dendur, which she and the president hoped to install in Washington, D.C., to, as she wrote, "remind people that feelings of the spirit are what prevent wars." John Kennedy would have been quick to affirm that the cultural milestones of his presidency, Pablo Casals in the American Ballet Theater in the East Room, the Mona Lisa displayed in America, the dinner for Nobel laureates, the efforts to develop a national theater, now the John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts, and others, would most likely have been absent had he not married Jacqueline Bouvier. Both Kennedys insisted that the arts must be included in any definition of a full American life. The affluent society of the early 1960s was a propitious moment for such a statement. Many Americans, enjoying post-war prosperity, were pondering how to spend their newfound discretionary income in leisure hours that their struggling forebears could only have dreamt of. Jacqueline Kennedy's acute sense of how symbols and ceremony could shape American life was never more evident than during the long, nightmare weekend after her husband's assassination. Remembering what she had read while restoring the mansion about Abraham Lincoln's funeral, the most elaborate in the country's history before 1963, the stunned widow improvised three unforgettable days of tone-perfect ceremony: the ritual in the East Room and Capitol Rotunda, the foreign leaders walking to the strangely intimate old cathedral, JFK's beloved Air Force One flying in salute above the burial, and the lighting of an eternal flame like the one she had seen in Paris as a student. After Dallas, all of this helped Americans win back at least some portion of their self-respect. Once the melancholy pageant was over, Mrs. Kennedy's command of public gesture remained. When she and her children officially departed the White House for the last time, she saw to it that her son John was carrying an American flag. In the summer of 1964, after finishing her interviews with Schlesinger, Jackie told a friend that recalling her bygone life had been excruciating. Plagued by the tourists around her Georgetown home and torturous reminders of a happier time, she moved her family to an apartment on Fifth Avenue in New York. She said she was seeking a new life in a new city. From her new bedroom windows, she could see across the street the Metropolitan Museum of Art, where, despite her preference for Washington, D.C., the Temple of Dendur was being installed, and at night, the floodlights bothered her. That autumn, on the first anniversary of the assassination, she wrote of her husband for Look magazine. She wrote, "So now he is a legend when he would have preferred to be a man. At least he will never know what sadness might have lain ahead." Almost as a resolution to herself, she added, "He is free, and we must live." After writing those words in longhand, Mrs. Kennedy never again mused in public about her husband. Not in 1965, when Queen Elizabeth dedicated an acre to him at the birthplace of the Magna Carta. Not in 1979, when she witnessed the opening of the Kennedy Library. Not ever. After she and her children settled in New York, she asserted her right to be a private citizen. She was content to allow the conversations in this book to be her principal contribution to the Kennedy historiography. In the spring of 1965, she read an early version of Arthur Schlesinger's forthcoming book, 1,000 Days, John F. Kennedy in the White House. She was upset to discover that the author had borrowed a number of items from their sealed conversations to describe the president's relationships with her and their children. She wrote him a letter asking him to remove, as she put it, "things I think are too personal. The world has no right to his private life with me. I shared all those rooms with him, not with the Book of the Month readers, and I don't want them snooping through those rooms now, even the bathtub with the children." Schlesinger complied, and by the time 1,000 Days was published, their friendship was restored. Despite her insistence on privacy, Jacqueline Kennedy never forgot her obligation to posterity. She always knew that when this oral history was published after her death, she would have what she expected to be the almost final word on her life with her husband. It was another of her innovations. With the reminiscences in this book, Jacqueline Kennedy became the first American president's wife to undergo hours of recorded questioning about her public and private life. Now, after decades in which her history has been left to others, listen to what she has to say.
The First Conversation, Monday, March 2nd, 1964.
Jackie, when do you think the president first began to think and act seriously about the presidency? When did he begin to see himself, do you suppose, as a possible president?
I think he was probably thinking about it for an awfully long time, long before I even knew. And I say this because I remember the first year we were married, I heard him at the Cape. He was in a room with his father talking, and I came in. And they were talking about something about the vice presidency. Well, that was just the year after he'd been elected a senator.
This is 1953.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I said, "Were you talking about being vice president or something like that?" And he sort of rather laughed or something, but I think it was always direct. Everything he did was always, he never stopped at any plateau. He was always going on to something higher. And so obviously after the vice presidential thing, well, then he was definitely aiming for the presidency, but I think it had been, I don't know, maybe when he first ran for the Senate. Well, certainly before I knew him.
I'm sure it must always have been in some sense in his mind. Is the story true that's been sometimes printed that the ambassador originally expected Joe to be the great political figure of the family?
Well, that's this sort of trite story that all these people who used to go to interview Mr. Kennedy, you get so tired of people asking for anecdotes. And he'd always produce this thing that Joe would have. And, well, now how can I say? Because I never knew Joe. And obviously, I suppose Joe would have run for politics, and then Jack, being so close to him, couldn't have run right on his heels in Massachusetts. Maybe he would have gone into something literary. But it's just not as simple as that story sounds. And then once Joe was dead, Mr. Kennedy didn't do any strange thing of saying, "Okay, now we run you." Everything just evolved. They came back from the war, and I don't know.
I agree. Well, the story has always sounded to be too pat and mechanical, and Joe was a classmate of mine at Harvard.
I've got a feeling from what I think of Joe and everything that he would have been so unimaginative compared to Jack. He would never have, I think he probably would have gotten to be a senator and not much higher. I don't know if that's prejudice, but I don't think he had any of the sort of imagination that Jack did. And
well, that was certainly, I knew him moderately well, and he did not have the imagination or the intellectual force or intellectual interest. He was a most attractive, charming fellow, and would have been, I think, very successful in politics, but I don't think could ever carried things to the point the president would. The vice presidency then was on his mind sort of sometime before 1956.
Well, it's funny, they were talking about that in, I guess around October, November 1953 at the Cape. But yet I know the night that Jack ran for the vice presidency in Chicago, he didn't want to then at all. And he, you know, and it was just a last minute thing when Stevenson threw the convention open, and all that taught them so much of how to do things at California in 1960, because no one was prepared. And I remember being in that office and Bobby trying to get someone to paint signs. I mean, he hadn't had it, you know, he wasn't trying for vice president.
In other words, when he came to Chicago in 56, he was not coming really to...
No, and he didn't want it. It was just when he didn't think... You know, he thought he would. Stevenson would be defeated, and it would be because, and one of the reasons would be because he would have been a Catholic on the ticket with him. So mm-hmm. It could only have been a hindrance to him. But then, when all that thing got thrown wide open, and I don't know who said make a race for it, or what, it just really happened that night.
It must have been in some sense in his mind, because I remember Ted Sorensen coming, or perhaps in, at least in Ted's mind, coming to see me on the Cape that summer before the convention and discussing this, and I telling Ted that I was for it and that I knew other people in the Stevenson circle were for it. Remember then Ted had a memorandum prepared on the Catholic vote.
Ah, yes. Oh, that's right. I didn't realize it was then. The funny thing with Jack that will make it very hard in these interviews for me to sound as if I make sense is that he never spoke of his sort of secret objectives or of plotting things. Life with him was always so fast, of what you were doing that day. He always talked at home of what he was thinking about or people. Mm-hmm. I mean, people say he never talked about politics at home with me, but it's all that was talked about. But he'd never sort of plot little goals and tell you when he was aiming for them then, and life with him was just so fast that it isn't until you look back that you see what happened when.
Mm-hmm. And people, life isn't like that in any way. I don't think people have objectives which they sort of plot to reach. There are things that are organic in them which emerge as they continue living and which are implanted and not sort of consciously striven for. And that's, I mean, when people do that, you get a kind of Nixon business, which is unattractive. And the president lives so intensely from day to day that the thing was rather implicit in his career, in his whole shape of his consciousness and destiny, rather than, I imagine, explicit in his mind or anything that he ever would talk about. But when he decided to run in for the vice presidency in 1956, what was it? Just the occasions, the suddenly overpowered him, you think? Or?
Well, I was out at the convention then with him in Chicago, but I was having a baby, and so I stayed with Eunice, and he lived in a hotel with Torb. And I saw him, you know, you'd see him in the day at the convention and you'd have dinner, but it was such, I can't tell you the confusion and the, you should talk to Torb about that. You know, he was so tired and he was working all the time. But it was, and every day was different. So I think it was when, I know he wanted, well, the worst fight in his life, which, you should ask me about sometime, is when he got control of the Massachusetts legislature, and that was to lead the Massachusetts delegation there, wasn't it?
Yes, against Bill Burke.
Yeah, against Onions Burke, because mm-hmm. that was the I only guess. Time of all the fights he's been through in his life, and I've really seen him nervous when he couldn't talk about anything else before. You know, and to get, so that was the big thing of all the spring, I guess, mm-hmm. was to, you know, to win that fight. And it really was on his mind all the time. So anyway, then he went out there as sort of an important person, and I guess had rather unsatisfactory couple of meetings with Stevenson. And then suddenly there was that night, and I remember I stayed up all night at the headquarters, and Bobby came running to me and said, we don't know anything. What do we do about Nevada? And I was in the little corner doing something with envelopes, getting someone to make signs, and I timidly said, I have an uncle who lives in Nevada. And nobody ever thought I had any political relatives or anything, but this uncle was a great friend of Pat McCarran. So we went in the little back room, Bobby and I, and called him up.
Who was the uncle?
Norman Biltz. And he's always been in Nevada politics. He's married to my stepfather's sister, Esther, who was before that married to Ogden Nash's brother. Then she married Norman Biltz, I think, and lived in Reno the rest of her life.
And Norman Biltz was a Democrat.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, but Pat McCarran and all these sort of types were all... Well, anyway, he is I don't know if he's shady because I love him, but he's certainly someone to know in Nevada. And he said, all right, because Nevada hadn't been for Jack, and the next day, all Nevada's votes were for Jack. So, all I know of that, when he decided, I don't know, but I just know that I knew that it was going for vice president that day, that night.
Mm-hmm.
And before, I suppose Torb could tell you that, because he was closeted in the room with him.
We'll talk to Torb. That's my memory, because I can remember Stevenson's decision to throw it open. And then again, Ted or someone from the president's staff getting in touch with me about things. And I think that though, well, obviously it was in the mind of some people around before, I think it had become dormant and then was suddenly revived. Let's talk about the fight against Bill Burke. It was really a fight against John McCormick, wasn't it? Yes.
And again, you know, you'd have to tell me about it, and I could tell you things that rang bells. Because it's...
Great problem was the control of the Democratic State Committee. And Burke had been put
and
in...
And Lynch, there was.
And Lynch, who was our man.
Yeah.
And who has been state chairman for the years since. Kenny and Larry were in that fight, but were they in?
I think so, yes.
They were, but I think neither of them yet had come on the Senate staff.
That's right. I think Kenny told me about that just now. I mean, just a couple of weeks ago. But you know, it was always in the first place, Jack was traveling a lot then, or then you'd be, but I can just remember every night talking. I remember at Jean's wedding. He was so busy up in Massachusetts, and she came, she had a dinner the night before she got married. Well, even Jack was going all around at that dinner, is talking to his father, talking to Bobby, Torb, everyone, sort of about this thing. It was just, you know, obsessing him, and because it was going to be known. She was married May 6th or something like that. May 19th she was married. And I guess the vote or whatever it is was going to come up a few days later, and I remember thinking, the only time in my life I've ever thought that Jack was a little bit thoughtless. But I didn't really think that, because you could see how worried he was. Because all that night, when everyone should have been making little toasts to Jean and things, which they were, and he made a touching one, he was talking to everybody about the dinner, about that fight.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was just on his mind. And I've never seen him like that in the first Cuba, the second Cuba, any election. I mean, the election, the presidential election, when I think of how calm he was that night, you know, whether it would come out well or not, but still.
Mm-hmm.
That was just all that spring. And as I have, you know, you mustn't think it bad that I don't have all these political memories, because I was really living another side of life with him. But that was all in it. But I just remember that was a terrible worry of all that spring.
I have the impression it must have been an awfully critical thing. It was the first big test of strength within the party organization. I know Kenny's told me from time to time, we've been talking about people in politics, and he would say, so-and-so, he was for us in the Burke fight, which meant we forget him everything else. Or someone, he was against us in the Burke fight. And this became the standard of judgment, which you know, years later in the presidential years, would still be very much in everyone's mind.
And I remember all the people. It fascinated me because when I came back from my honeymoon, I was taken immediately to Boston to be registered as a Democrat by Patsy Mulkern, who was called the China Doll because he was a prize fighter once. And he took me all up and down that street and told me duking people means shaking hands and things. And then there was another man with onion spirit named Juicy Granera.
Oh, yes.
Well, I mean, those names just fascinated me so. You know, and sort of see that world, and then you'd go have dinner at the Ritz.
Yes, yes.
So, then you'd be going someplace else. It just seems it was suitcases, moving, that. Then you go to New York for a couple of days. We never had our own house until we'd been married 4 years. So I can't tell you.
That was in Georgetown or out in McLean?
Oh, no, that's right. We had one for 3 years in Hickory Hill. Yeah, mm-hmm. We didn't buy a house. You know, but we'd rent for January till June. Then we'd go live at my mother's house, which was in Virginia, for the summer, because we didn't have a child for 4 years. So the summers we'd spend at her house, going up to the Cape when we could on weekends, and in the fall we'd stay with his father in, you know, living right with our in-laws, and then we'd go to his apartment in Boston, or we'd go down to New York for a couple of days, or it was terrifically nomadic, you know, and then we'd go away at after Christmas or something for a few days to Jamaica or something. Such a pace when I think of